There is no band. Il n'est pas d'orchestre. This is all a tape recording.
The boys are back in town for episode number 55 of the Cut Print Film Podcast. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Hey, everybody. It's the Cut Print Film Podcast. What episode number?
55.
I'm your host, Dave Costell.
I'm also your host, Jeff Rollins, as the car.
And I don't know. I'm confused now, but I'm another host. My name's Chris Evangelista.
As himself.
Oh, thanks.
I'm also myself. I'm a half man, half car type being.
Oh, okay. Makes sense. We're off to a rousing start.
Yes.
I'm a little sick this week, so if you're wondering why I sound like a man for once, because
Dave's
definitely ill.
He's becoming a young man, finally. Yes. He's sprouting hair in all sorts of places. The tip of his nose. Dave, what's wrong with your nose?
But I ran out of Cut Print Film sick time, so I had to come in today.
Yeah, we've been off for a week. Now we're back.
Yeah, we've had some technical difficulties. This is the third time we've tried to record this podcast.
Yes.
And it's like I always say, once, twice, three times a podcast. Right, everyone?
We ran into trouble because Jeff put bomb bags all over the studio and stepped on them and ran. And they blew up all our equipment.
Now there's weird little white powder juice on everything.
Yeah, it's not a good scene. And we're currently recording on an old Casio.
Yes.
So, and I don't even know how we're doing it, but it's working.
So we're a movie podcast, and we have a website, and it's called cutprintfilm.com.
What can you find on cutprintfilm.com?
Oh, what can't
recipes,
you find?
Recipes.
Nutrition information.
Tips.
Shoes. There are reviews. There are editorials. There are interviews. You name it, we got it.
Mm-hmm. Lots of reviews. We pretty much review every single movie that comes out. Pretty especially much. The ones you've never heard of.
Right. Yes. Yeah. If you've made a movie and you want someone to review it, just email it to us.
We'll say, hey, we have a crack team member and we can assign this to on the spot.
That's right.
Yeah, we specialize in pretty much indie films. That's our specialty.
But we like to think we cover everything.
There's we have a balanced film diet.
Right.
I'm eating Pinocchio, the original Disney version, right now.
Sounds delicious.
Yes, it's very carb heavy, though.
We have at least one Universal Soldier review up a week.
A week, yeah.
Well, there's so many of those films.
There's about three. Anyway.
Yeah, let's get down to business, guys.
Let's get down to brass tacks,
yes.
Shall we?
These tacks are really hurting my feet. I should have wore boots. A very big movie came out this past week.
That's right. It was called Last Night. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
No.
That's the Clive Owen movie that no one saw.
It was called Furious 7, and our very own Chris Evangelista went to the screening and reviewed it at cutprintfilm.com.
I sure did. I went all the way out to King of Prussia.
How is the King of Prussia?
He's all right. His hat is really big.
He should really knock it off with that whole slavery issue. I don't like that.
No one.
In 2015, unnecessary.
Yeah, he's a bit out of sorts.
That's why we have unions.
So, I went to see Furious 7. It is, of course, the seventh film in the Fast and Furious franchise.
So it must have been the luckiest.
Yes, it was.
Was it the 11th film?
Yes, it was a lucky number 11. The film came out over the weekend. It made boffo box office. It broke all sorts of records.
$143 million.
That's a lot of money.
Yes, it is.
Right.
Especially for a Herbie film.
Yes. Obviously, there was a lot of buzz around this film, both because everyone loves the franchise, apparently, and also, of course, Paul Walker died while they were making the film, so everyone sort of... It's like that morbid curiosity thing. Like
he was dedicated to the movie.
He was.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Does he die in the movie?
No, he
doesn't. That would be insensitive.
But the movie gives him a nice little, his character a send off, because obviously he won't be in the future films.
Yeah. It's like the end of Drive when he drives away into the sunset.
Actually, that is exactly what happens. Yeah, spoiler, Paul Walker, he drives into the sunset.
He drives into the sun.
Yeah, literally. The car launches into space.
He has the payload on the back of his vroom vroom car. And it's like that film Sunshine. That's what I'm really getting at here with this joke.
Oh, all right. I love it.
Continue,
Sunshine,
Chris.
Joke. Furious 7, I'm not the biggest Furious fan, I guess.
Is there a cool custom rap song in it?
There's a lot.
Furious 7, gotta get 11 points on my I don't know.
That doesn't
have
a
good rapper.
But there are plenty of songs I've never heard of because I'm not with it in this film.
Yes, we're all old people.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the franchise. I mean, I've seen the first one. The first one is pretty much, it's a Point Break ripoff, but instead of surfing, it's car racing. But it's the same plot where it's this FBI agent who goes undercover with these thieves and becomes one of them. It's literally the same plot.
It doesn't sound bad. I'm not big into car culture, and that's what I kind of thought that these movies were all going to be. Am I
even
correct?
You're half car.
Well, I am half car, but I'm embarrassed by my culture. Okay.
Well, the
self-hating car man.
The franchise did an interesting thing because the first three movies or four movies, whatever the hell it was, they're very much about.
Just say six, because
it's between one and six.
Okay,
it's between one and five. Sorry, between one and five, the movies are very much about car culture. Mm-hmm. And then Universal Studios, they changed it up and they made it sort of like heist films. They're sort of like a James Bond meets Ocean's 11 with cars.
Okay.
And that's sort of how the franchise became more universally accepted.
So that's 6 and 7.
6 and 7 are the heist movies. And this, actually, yeah, 5, 6, and 7.
5, 6, and 7, okay.
Are the heist films. And they're the more enjoyable ones. So of all the ones I've seen, I will say I did like this one the most. It's the most enjoyable. It has a new director, James Wan, took over the franchise, who, of course, he's known more for his horror films, which I
do not like at all.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the James Wan horror films, especially the earlier. I love he made a film called Dead Silence, which is about creepy puppets. And I love that movie. It's a stupid horror movie, but I like it.
Yeah. I believe you recommended it once.
Probably.
Not on this podcast, though.
Yeah, on my Dead Silence podcast.
Exactly.
But the action, it's really well done in this movie. It's filmed well. It's concise. It's not messy. It's not that action movies have tended to get to this point where the camera is shaking all over the place.
That's the Michael Bay effect.
Yeah, it's also like a cost-cutting method because you don't have to frame things if it's cheap.
You don't have to leave the studio. You can just move the camera fast against the wall and it looks like something happened.
Right, and with this film you can tell James Wan and everyone, they're trying to make the action look as clear as they possibly can.
Oh, I'm looking at box office here. That number I gave, the $143 million, that was domestic. Worldwide, this movie made $384 million.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
Good God.
How did It Follows do? Because that opened wide.
I don't know.
Didn't it?
I think it also made $340 million.
That's the best bet. That's where the smart money's on.
Yes.
See, like I said, I don't know a whole lot about these films. I know Vin Diesel is in them.
Right, he's sort of the main guy, and he's sort of the leader of this crew, and Paul Walker is sort of like his best friend. Also, The Rock is in this movie.
When did he join the franchise?
Rock joined in part 5.
Okay, so when it started getting good.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And The Rock is, as always, the most enjoyable thing, one of the most enjoyable things in this film. But actually, the most enjoyable aspect of this film is Kurt Russell, who is new to the franchise, and holy shit, is he having a lot of fun in this film.
I like when Kurt Russell is just let loose.
I do, too. I mean, Kurt
Russell, like in R.I.P.D. What a good film that is.
Kurt Russell, he's still got it. He's clearly having just a blast being in, like, a real franchise. Because for a while, Sylvester Stallone kept trying to get him into The Expendables.
Yeah, see,
no, he's
that's
not.
That's what I was just about to ask.
He kept turning it down, and for good reason, because those movies stink. And in this, he's clearly having fun. He plays like a CIA agent. He's sort of like, he's like the Nick Fury of the Furious world. Mm. He gets everyone together to go on a mission.
I just realized I got Jeff Bridges and Kurt Russell mixed up.
Yeah, I did too, but I didn't want to correct you.
Oh, I wanted to correct myself, but I also don't care very much. So continue.
But yeah, Kurt Russell's great in this. He's just, it's every time he's on screen, it's just fun to watch. And Jason Statham is the bad guy. He's fun to watch.
I like Jason Statham.
I do too. But he's not actually in it a lot. I was actually disappointed. Jason Statham, he's sort of like Jason Voorhees in this film. He just randomly shows up wherever the characters are, and they literally go all over the world. Like they go to Abu Dhabi, and they go, but no matter what part,
do they find Nermal there from the Garfield comics?
Yes.
Okay.
No matter where they go,
I've been curious where Nermal's been.
Yes. Don't they ever get bored of stealing
cars?
There's
a scene where Vin Diesel in Abu Dhabi gets a package and he opens it up and Nermal is inside.
To his dismay, it's Nermal. It's both Nermal and Odie.
Yes, Garfield shipped him there. That's enough Garfield jokes for this segment. But yeah, no matter where they are, somehow Jason Statham knows how to find them. And it's a silly movie, but like, if you like this franchise, I can see no reason why you wouldn't like this installment.
I like Dave's question, though. Like, wouldn't you get tired of stealing cars? Yeah.
They don't really, it's like, it's not really.
I would.
A, see, because now that it's a heist.
Would you be eventually charged with a felony?
Well, as the in the fifth and sixth movies, it's all about them getting their names cleared and getting, because
so there's a lot of paperwork involved?
Yeah, there is. Well, there's a lot of jokes about how The Rock hates doing paperwork, because he's like a FBI agent or something. I don't even know what the fuck he is.
Mm.
He's a big, muscular man.
He looks like a bookworm.
Yeah.
he's pushing pencils. I can see that just crystal clear.
My favorite scene in Furious 7 involves the Rock's character. He gets injured early in the film, and that's just an excuse to have him not in the movie the whole time, because
The Undertaker hurt him.
Yeah, he did.
Death Valley Driver.
I believe it was Chris Benoit put him in a chokehold.
Well, and that's very upsetting because he's a dead man.
No, The Rock gets injured because he's a busy film actor now, so he was doing another film at the time. I think he was doing Hercules while they were filming this. But he shows up at the end, and he's in the hospital, and he sees, you know, the Furious gang's in trouble, so he's like, I gotta go to work. So he literally flexes a muscle, and it snaps his cast off his arm. And I enjoyed that immensely, just seeing that. It was fantastic.
So this is just goofy at this point.
It's good. It's like, at this point, they know how silly the franchise is, and they're having fun.
I really appreciate when a franchise knows exactly what it is now, has its footing, has its like feet on even ground, and it knows, okay, here's what we're doing.
Right, and that's why I think I liked this one the most, because out of 5 and 6, they're enjoyable, and you can tell that's when they're starting to get that, oh, let's make these silly, and this film is just full silly. Like, there's no bullshit drama in this movie. It's clearly like, oh, we know how goofy this is, let's have fun with it.
Do they have friends or family?
Oh,
that's the big question.
Well,
everyone's asking.
You might think they're friends, but oh no, they're family. There's a big they love saying family in this movie. They're all
so they're all on the same cell phone plan.
Yeah,
yeah. They all go to
they're on Sprint's family plan, I believe.
Yeah, they go to the Olive Garden because they're all family there.
Yes, they get the never-ending breadsticks.
Endless breadsticks.
Does anyone Tokyo Drift in this?
They do reference Tokyo Drift in this film, because Tokyo Drift, this franchise is so convoluted that Tokyo Drift is actually a prequel to part, even though it's the third film, I believe, it's a prequel to part 5.
See, that means it's just got a rich mythology.
It's pretty much, it's like, I say this in my review, that it's pretty much like the Friday the 13th franchise at this point, where they have this insane, complicated mythology. Yeah.
For no reason,
but
they're already doing that with the Man of Steel franchise. Did you see that Suicide Squad is going to take place before
Superman,
the new
Batman
Superman movie comes out, but it's going to release after it?
Whatever.
So that'll make things really easy to follow.
I love all this.
I mean, yeah, if there's one thing I love, it's cinematic universes.
Yeah, can't get enough of them. I'm looking forward to the Bridges of Madison County cinematic universe.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I bet they try to branch this off into two different universes.
I'm sure eventually they will, but who knows. But yeah, so bottom line, this is an enjoyable
it's a good movie.
It's fun. I mean, you know, good is a subjective word.
It's pretty great.
Yeah, I'd say it's a grand old flag of a film.
I like that.
And
too specific.
So yeah, I gave it a 7. Obviously, everyone's probably seen it by now since it made all the money in the world.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're on the fence for some reason with Furious 7,
get off the fence and go see the movie.
Yeah.
Man. Why are you on a fence?
Yeah, I hope you're wearing jeans at least, and that you're not nude on top of this fence.
Yes.
You could tear something.
So yeah, Furious 7 in theaters now.
Go see it, everyone.
So what happens next on this podcast?
I believe the last live episode, we asked for letters from our audience, and let's bring that up again because we want you.
Ding dong.
The
Cutthroat Film Mailman.
Let me fucking explain this. We want you.
I'm sorry, I pressed the button and it played. I couldn't stop it.
All this time, you could have been looking up a real doorbell sign, by the way. We want you, the listening audience of Cutprint Film, to be involved with this podcast. So
yes.
If you have something you want to ask us, say to us, why not email us at info@cutprintfilm.com.
That's right. Send it on over. Ask us anything you want, preferably movie-related, but, you know, say you want to know, Jeff, what's your waist and inseam? I'll be glad to answer. 5428.
Wow.
Yes, I'm a monstrous man. I'm taller laying down.
Oh my
so,
God.
Jeff, do you want to reach into the cup for film bag and
hang on.
Pick something out here?
I'm sorry, we have hurricane force winds in the studio.
There's gale winds. Dave, I have to talk to you. There's a bear trap at the bottom of the bag. Was that meant for me?
No, that was meant for the bear that is going to come later and check out that bag.
Lord Almighty. All right, here, I'll hand it off to Chris.
Oh, I'm reading it? Okay.
If you want.
All right, let's see. This is from Marv. Good name. In
Yes. Sorry. Yes, we'll also make fun of your name if you choose to write in. What would stop anybody from being made fun of?
I'm just not used to the name Marv, that's all. I don't know.
Sorry, Marv.
The only Marv I know is the one from the Wet/Sticky Bandits. And hopefully this isn't him. If so, he's wanted for crimes. He's from Studio City, California. He says, hey guys, with the announcement from Disney of the live-action Winnie the Pooh movie, along with the other live-action films in development, I was wondering what Disney movie you guys would remake and which director you would hire to direct it, with many, many exclamation points at the end and question marks.
Okay.
All right.
Marv's an excitable chap.
Yeah. He's really curious.
So thanks, Marv.
Okay. Well, I didn't think of anything before the show, so who wants to go first?
Dave, why don't you go?
Hold on. Let me look up Disney D.I. Okay, yeah. Actually, I thought it up before. I'm just joking about all that typing.
Teehee. Good joke, everyone.
You fooled me.
The remakes seem to be very princess heavy. Have you guys noticed that?
Yeah.
They're all, I mean,
Prince hasn't been in one of them.
Yeah, no princes at all.
Yeah.
But the song Two Princes from The Spin Doctors is in the film, I believe. It's in all of these Disney films. It's really weird.
So I was thinking that this would be a cool movie to remake, Tarzan, because it wasn't a very good Disney movie in the first place.
I never saw, that's one of those ones I just never got around to seeing.
And it has like, there's no princess in it, which I think is kind of cool. It just has like the female of Jane.
Yeah.
Based on what's her name? Jane.
Jane Austen.
No, it's not at all. Jane Goodall, is that it? Yeah.
I sincerely doubt it's based on that since these books were written in the 1800s before she was born.
Yes. That's a good bet, Chris.
Well, I'm sick, so I get a pass.
Dave's all hopped up on medicines.
So I would make that, and I think with even though I didn't really like Noah very much, I think that Darren Aronofsky could make a movie like Tarzan in that same vein as Noah and make it kind of cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I could see that.
Like very jungly and wildernessy.
Well, there's a lot of like jungle stuff in like the fountain too. So yeah, he could actually make.
Yeah,
it
that's
work.
True. Like that, all that Spanish conquistador stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So just like that, I think I would want it to be a little more adult than the last few have been.
Yeah.
I don't think there's been any that was Maleficent like violent at all.
Not really.
It was
adult. There was some adult theme, like because there's a rape theme,
right?
Which I mean,
which but you want in all your Disney movies.
You gotta have it. You gotta have it. But if you're not savvy enough to realize it, then it'll just go over a kid's head. So that was one of the few things I liked about Maleficent was that.
Well, I'm pretty savvy, so.
All right, you
are. I can spot those adult themes when I see them.
Excellent, Dave. I hope so. You're 30 years old.
All right, Marv, I hope you're happy.
No, that was just you that went. It's Chris and I haven't gone.
I hope you're happy. Said in a very bitter way.
I will go.
See what you've done.
I would do Treasure Planet, which came out in 2002.
Oh, I forgot about
and
that.
And it was kind of a flopperoonie.
Yes, it was.
Because it took place around, you know, Toy Story had already been out, and they were already doing the CGI thing. Pixar was enormous, and DreamWorks was doing their thing. So Disney traditional animation kind of fell by the wayside. So I'd go with Treasure Planet, and I'm going to go with James Gunn, just because it's such a cool space opera based on literary fiction, which is, you know, Guardians sort of is.
Yeah, I could kind of see that now that you say James Gunn. Like,
and it would just be neat to see these pirate ships floating through space with James Gunn's, you know, kind of offbeat sense of humor to it. I would really like that. So, yes, Treasure Planet, directed by James Gunn, is my pick, Marv.
Yeah. My pick, Marv, is 1986, The Great Mouse Detective, which,
ooh,
when I was a kid, this was probably my favorite Disney movie.
Who would play The Great Mouse Detective?
How would you make a live action?
I'd have Charles Cheese The Great Mouse.
Let me explain. The Great Mouse Detective, it was my favorite Disney movie because it had Vincent Price in it as Radigan, the villain. I know he's dead, Dave. I went to his funeral.
Did you leave a rose on his tomb?
I go there every weekend.
So you're the guy.
And I whisper to his grave, "The price is right."
You say, "As a vis-a-vis, I kiss my rose."
I don't say that. No. That's just gibberish until the final part. Anyway, Tim Burton is doing a live-action Dumbo, which is probably the worst idea I've ever heard.
Correct.
But at the same time, I feel like Tim Burton actually would be able to pull off a live-action Great Mouse Detective. And obviously, by live-action, I mean it would have to be a mix of CGI and live-action. But that's what I'm picturing with you.
Oh, like in real environments?
Right, like real environments, but like CGI sort of characters. Kind of like,
didn't Stuart Little sort of...
Sort of like Stuart Little, but with like, you know, better modern effects.
Yeah.
Or you could like kill a mouse and put it on like a little stick.
Yeah, exactly.
Shake it around in front of the camera.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going for.
That's horrific.
Put a little tuxedo on him.
Yeah, but
like, I was prepared for the party.
I mean, I'm ignoring you. As hacky and terrible as Tim Burton is now, I'm always going to hold out hope that he's just going to have that one comeback. And you know,
you're a better man than I.
I feel like
it wasn't big eyes. I'll tell you that.
And like, I feel like he should play to his strengths, and this would be something like
his muscly arms.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, his traps.
Yeah.
So now that everyone's talked over it, that was my pick.
Oh, sorry.
The Great Mouse Detective.
Great Mouse Detective. I liked that movie.
I loved it.
I loved it as a kid.
Kind of
it's kind of scary.
It is. That's why I liked it. Anything with Vincent Price in it has my seal of approval.
All right. Good picks, everybody. And thank you for writing in, Marv. I feel like that's a fake name. I don't believe your name's Marv.
His last name is The Martian, so I don't know.
All right. So... Yeah, that does it for our mailbag segment, our mailman, print film mailman.
We'll have to think of a better title for that.
No, I like that.
You like the mailman?
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll be back with Mulholland Drive.
That's right. Yes, we will.
Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of cutprintfilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
Cutprint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do. It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Lemons.
Hey, all you groovy cats.
Hip cats. Welcome back.
That's not my tempo. This joke again.
Yeah, please stop.
All right.
I can't turn you down, Jeff. Oh, there you go.
I'll turn myself down.
No, I got
Dave.
It. Don't touch it.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about, finally, David Lynch's Mulholland Drive.
That's right. This was the film that inspired this director series because, what was his name? Will?
Marv?
Oh. No, Marv was the guy from today. Will, also from California.
Will with one L.
Yes. Will, who I believe is an actual name. From California.
You think him and Marv are friends?
I hope so.
Probably not. California is an enormous state.
Is it? I don't know.
It is. It's almost the entire size of the East Coast.
So yeah, the director series, for those who don't know by now, it's a thing where we pick a director, and then we pick three films, and we talk about those three films over a series of three shows.
Yes.
And as always, we encourage you at home to write in, tweet at us at Cutprint Film, a director you want us to talk about for the director series.
And as always, I have a piece of production to play.
It's the Cutprint Film Director Series.
Action!
Directors!
Pass the popcorn. Put a piece in my mouth.
And that's that.
Yeah, that cleared things up for me because I was confused.
Everyone at home, settle a bet for me. Would you buy a shirt with Jeff's face on it that said, "Put a piece in my mouth"?
The answer will surprise you.
Write in and let us know. And if we get enough yeses, we'll make it for our cafe press store.
It'll only be $45 to cover all our expenses.
And it'll only be in long sleeve t-shirts.
Okay, so David Lynch's Mulholland Drive.
That's right.
What's
it about?
Well,
We'll never know.
That's the sort of question only an asshole would ask. I'm certain of it. This film came out in 2001.
It was directed
by David Lynch, starring Naomi Watts, Laura Harring, Justin Theroux, and really starring Billy Bob Thornton.
Allegedly.
No, not Billy Bob Thornton.
Billy Ray Cyrus.
Billy Raymond Cyrus.
That's right.
Yes, my favorite actor.
I believe he's playing himself in this film.
He is. He's got a gorgeous mullet, which I can't wait to talk at length about.
Well, that's why it's called Mulholland Drive.
It sure is. Did anybody have anything to say before I get into this plot synopsis?
Let's save what we have to say for after the synopsis.
I have some things to say, but they don't relate to Mulholland Drive at all. No.
Well, I noticed none of you discussed my new tattoo. I'd like to discuss that now.
All right, please tell us.
It's a bag of Doritos that you got tattooed on your arm.
A dark-haired woman escapes her own murder, surviving a car accident on Mulholland Drive.
Oh, that's why they call it that.
Yes, and that explains everything.
That's right. Good night, everyone.
Injured and in shock, she descends into Los Angeles. Detectives investigating the crash indicate that they suspect a woman has made her way down into the city. At daybreak, she sneaks into an apartment which an older red-haired woman is just vacating. In a diner called Winkie's, a man tells his companion about a nightmare in which he dreamed there was a horrible figure behind the diner. When they go to investigate, the figure appears, causing the man to die of fright.
This is probably one of my favorite scenes in it. There's a lot of scenes in this film that I would call my favorite, but God, do I love this sequence.
It's excellent. While the dark-haired woman sleeps, a series of mysterious and sinister phone calls are made concerning her whereabouts. An aspiring actress named Betty Elms, played by Naomi Watts, arrives at Los Angeles Airport with two accidental traveling companions. They are the trio seen in the opening sequence featuring Betty Elms in a jitterbug contest.
That's right, featuring that swinging music
that you just heard. The elderly couple is seen leaving in a blackened-out limousine, smiling ominously at one another like lunatics.
It's very disturbing.
Yes, it is. Betty arrives at the apartment, which is her aunt's, that the dark-haired woman has entered, and assumes she is there because her aunt allowed it. Betty tells her how happy she is to be in, quote-unquote, this dream place. Yeah. The woman is suffering from amnesia and assumes her name is Rita after seeing a poster for the film Gilda starring Rita Hayworth. Later, a hitman, Joe Messing, played by Mark Pellegrino, who you might recognize from Lost.
That's right. He's also on Supernatural.
He bungles a hit, and boy does he ever.
This is another favorite scene in this film.
Yes, he goes to kill, I'm assuming this guy's a screenwriter or a press agent.
Something like that, yeah.
And he ends up murdering three people, shooting a phone, causing a fire, a vacuum explodes.
Yeah, it's great.
It's fantastic. Is everybody still with me?
Yes. No.
Okay. All right. A Hollywood director named Adam Kesher, played by the fantastic Justin Theroux, pre-abs, but not post-enormous clothing.
Yeah, I believe he got his clothes from the circus for this film. He's wearing the baggiest clothes I've ever seen. Yes. And I used to be really, really fat, so that says something.
He has his film.
What is the 90s?
That's
true. No, it's not.
It's 2001. It's the 2000 onesies. he has his film commandeered by apparent mobsters who insist he cast an unknown actress named Camilla Rhodes, played by Melissa George, as the lead in his film. After he resists, he leaves the building and smashes the mobster's car with a golf club and runs away.
Golf club that he just has.
Yes, he walks with it. While he's driving, he receives a call from his secretary informing him that Ray, his production manager, fired all of his staff. She implores him to drive to his office to sort out the situation, but he ultimately decides to go home. Uh-oh, wrong move. He returns home to find his wife having an affair with a man named Gene, played by Billy Ray Cyrus.
Yes.
The pool man.
Yes, Gene the pool man. And if anybody mentions that Gene Pool has anything to do with this movie, I will pull your shirt over your head and punch you in the stomach.
Well, let me just throw out my notes.
After he finds his wife in bed with Billy Ray Cyrus, he destroys his wife's jewelry with pink paint out of impulse and pushes her against the wall.
Pink paint? What does that symbolize?
Probably nothing.
Pink Panther, I believe.
Yes.
Maybe it's the Gene Pool.
No, stop. Everyone stop with that.
Good one, Dave.
Throw that theory out. Gene intervenes and throws him out of his own house.
See?
He later learns that his bank has been closed and his line of credit, and he is broke. At his agent's advice, he agrees to meet a mysterious figure called the Cowboy, played by Monty Montgomery, one of my favorite characters in this film, who tells him to cast Camilla Rhodes for his own good. And they have a great exchange.
It's so good.
Betty, once again, remember her? She's played by Naomi Watts, promises to help Rita remember her identity, and the two of them find a large amount of money and an unusual blue key, which is, was it the shape of a triangle?
Yes.
Okay. In Rita's purse, trying to learn more
It's the thing from Man of Steel.
Yes, it is. It's the thumb drive.
Yes.
That unlocks Russell Crowe.
He's the one who comes out of the box at the end. Yes. Spoiler.
Trying to learn more about Rita's accident, Betty and Rita go to Winkie's and are served by a waitress named Diane, which causes Rita to remember the name Diane Selwyn. They find Diane Selwyn in the phone book and call her, but she does not answer. Of course, it's Naomi Watts on the voicemail.
God, Jeff, spoiler. I haven't watched this movie yet.
Diane.
Oh,
Diane.
Diet Coke.
Gene Pool.
I love all this, Dave. Go on.
This is the witty banner we all tune in for.
Go on for hours.
So yeah, they sort of turn into like Nancy Drew, and they go investigating the house.
They're Cam Jansen, if you will.
Yes.
Betty goes to an audition that Rita helped her prepare for, where she has the greatest audition I've ever seen in my entire life.
So Naomi Watts is so good in this movie.
A casting agent takes her to the set of a film called The Sylvia North Story, directed by Adam Kesher, where Camilla Rhodes gives an audition, and Adam declares, "This is the girl."
That's right.
After casting Camilla as the lead, he turns around and looks straight at Betty. Betty flees before she can meet Adam, saying that she promised to meet a friend, which is Rita. Betty and Rita go to Diane Selwyn's apartment and break in when no one answers the door. In the bedroom, they find a body of a woman who has been dead for, this says several days, I'm going to say weeks.
It's very decomposed.
Yes. It looks like the body in the closet from The Ring.
It does, actually, yeah.
Terrified, they return to their apartment where Rita disguises herself with a blonde wig, looking more and more like Betty. The two have sex that night, and Betty tells Rita that she loves her. Later, they awake at 2 a.m. when Rita insists that they go to an eerie theater called Club Silencio.
That's right. That's where I got married.
Yeah. On stage, a man explains in both Spanish and English that everything is an illusion. He is followed by a woman who sings Roy Orbison's Crying, a lip-syncing, and in a cappella, and she collapses mid-song as the vocals continue. Betty finds a blue box in her purse that matches Rita's key, and
God.
What happened?
A blue box.
Oh, boy. Where are you going with this one?
Gene Pool.
This stinks.
Pools are blue.
Upon returning to their apartment, Rita retrieves the key and finds that Betty has disappeared completely. Rita unlocks the box and it falls to the floor. The older redheaded woman investigates the sound, but nothing is there.
Ooh.
The cowboy appears in the doorway of Diane Selwyn's bedroom saying, "Hey, pretty girl, time to wake up." And Diane Selwyn, played by Naomi Watts, Dave has collapsed onto the floor at this point. Diane Selwyn, played by Watts, wakes up in her bed.
I have my phone alarm programmed to say, "Hey, pretty girl, time to wake up."
That's very nice.
It just wakes me up every morning.
Oh, I thought that was your dinner bell.
Well, both.
Diane Selwyn, played by Naomi Watts, wakes up in bed and she looks exactly like Betty, but is portrayed as a failed actress driven in a deep depression by her unrequited love for Camilla Rhodes, played by Laura Harring. On Camilla's invitation,
Diane?
Let's not.
Is that
do
who
this.
She is?
Let's let me read on. On Camilla's invitation, Diane attends a party at Adam Kesher's house on Mulholland Drive. Her limousine stops before they reach the house, and Camilla escorts her using a shortcut through the woods. Adam appears to be in love with Camilla, and over dinner, Diane states that she came to Hollywood when her aunt died.
And also, it's worth pointing out that everyone at this dinner party is pretty much everyone in the movie.
It's a regular Wizard of Oz moment.
Yes.
And you were there, and you were there. The Tin Man was there, too.
That's right, yeah.
Chris was there. You're sitting in the back.
I was.
Yeah.
It was a really good party. You guys should have come.
Diane states that she came to Hollywood when her aunt died, and she met Camilla at an audition for the Sylvia North story. Another woman, played by Melissa George, kisses Camilla, and they turn and smile at Diane. Adam and Camilla prepare to make an important announcement, but they dissolve into laughter and kiss while Diane watches crying.
I gotta say, in a film filled with weird scenes, that's probably the thing I find the most weird is that scene where they're just like,
we have an announcement, and they just keep laughing.
So unnatural.
It's very weird.
Diane meets with the hitman Messing at Winky's, where she gives him Camilla's photo and a large amount of money, and they are served by a waitress named Betty. Messing tells Diane that when the job is done, she will find a blue key. Diane asks what, if anything, the key opens, but Messing just laughs. Diane looks up and sees the man who had the nightmare standing at the counter. The blue box is shown in possession of the monster around the back of the diner. And back at her apartment, with the blue key on the table in front of her indicating that the hit has been taken out, Diane is terrorized by hallucinations of the elderly couple that you saw in the beginning of the film.
Right.
She runs screaming to her bed, where she shoots herself. And the final scene, a woman previously seen at the club whispers, "Silencio." And that is the convoluted, bizarre plot of Mulholland Drive.
Yes.
Let's get into it.
So, what did you think, Jeff, of Mulholland Drive?
I loved Mulholland Drive.
Hooray! I will say I also loved Mulholland Drive.
And when I say I love it, I mean I love this movie.
It's a fantastic movie. But Dave, what do you think of Mulholland Drive?
I did not particularly enjoy Mulholland Drive.
Okay, so we're gonna workshop this and see what we can get at it.
Let me get out my bandsaw.
I recognize is a strange opinion to have.
No, it's not strange. This is a very weird movie.
It's
obviously
polarizing too.
Absolutely. But I
literally, because there's two halves to it.
Well, I wouldn't call them halves. I call 7/8 of one and an eighth of another.
There are two cubits by
And I love weird mystery stuff. Like, I love enemy, like, things.
Right.
Like, loose ends don't bother me.
Yeah.
All right? That's not my issue with this film.
I would argue this film doesn't actually have loose ends.
I think this is a very circular film with no loose ends.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people think this film is weirder than it is.
Yeah.
So, let's get into it. Let's talk about some of the aspects of Mulholland Drive.
Okay. I want to present my theory, which I think is the right theory. It's not something that I came up entirely on my own.
Right.
A lot of people are on the side of this theory, and that is that most
the Dharma Initiative is Kaiser Soze.
Well, I'm confused. You both threw two different theories at me. I think this was an inside job, and it's all Bush's fault.
Look, all I'm saying is jet fuel.
Yeah, and thermite paint.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, now that we've got that out of the way, my theory on Mulholland
Drive. This movie came out in 2001.
It certainly did, Dave.
All right, let's stop entering Jeff before he murders us.
My theory on Mulholland Drive is that the first 2 hours of this film are a dream. They're the actress Diane Selwyn's dream, and the final 20 minutes are out of order, but they are Diane Selwyn in waking life.
I would say absolutely. Okay. I know this. No film is, you know, this is a film that there's no right answer, but honestly, I think that is...
I think that's the right answer.
That's the only way you really can really look at it.
I know that people have a lot of fun pulling theories out of this film and making it their own, but I don't want to hear any other theory but this dream theory, because I think that is the movie.
I was looking up various theories, and someone was like, I have a theory that the whole film is a dream of Diane's aunt. Like, shut up. No, it's clearly not that.
It makes too much sense for this to be the actress Diane Selwyn's dream after she puts a hit out on her ex-lover who doesn't requite her love. And
the way it is when after she opens the box and she wakes up and she's Diane again, that is her then flashing back to everything that she did that caused the dream.
Right.
And then she kills herself.
Yeah. And like I said, I don't want to hear any other theories about Mulholland Drive. That is what I think.
What if
the
end's a dream?
No.
The beginning is real.
Let's stop it right now.
See, I've read that theory too, but I feel like too many fantastical stuff happens in the first half. The first half is really when all the weird stuff happens.
Yeah.
The
monster's still in the second half.
Yes, but the monster, I think, is just Diane, because they at the very end, Lynch does a shot where he has a close-up on the monster's face, and it fades into a shot of Diane at the jitterbug thing laughing. Yeah. So the monster is how she sees herself for having lover killed.
I take the monster is her guilt manifested
that's another way,
and personified. That's what I think the monster is.
I mean, the only
monsterfied.
Yeah, it's been monster. It's been monster beverage.
I mean, the only really fantastical thing that happens at the end is the old couple who
are tiny,
who creepily stop motion dance out of the box, and then they chase her. That scene is terrifying.
It is terrifying.
They're just and
they crawl under the door.
At the same time, I imagine filming it was just ridiculous because it's literally just old people going like "ooga booga" and Naomi Watts screaming her head off. Yeah. But Lynch has such a eye for making things creepy that just the way it's shot is just very disturbing.
And that is what I love about this film, is the way it's shot. This is one of the most cinematic films I've ever seen. Right. And the first 2 hours that are all a dream, even though it feels like a dream,
right,
it looks beautiful, as though it's this sweeping Hollywood drama epic. And it's one of the most cinematic films. It might be Lynch's most cinematic film as far as you know, a big Hollywood big budget goes.
Right. And what makes that more all the more remarkable is this was originally supposed to be a TV pilot.
Yeah.
And a lot of the footage in the film was shot for the pilot.
Yeah. It feels like it too. Like, I think that's part of the incongruity of it, like the fact that it was made to be a whole series, so there's stuff that's left out because there's just not room for it, and then that creates kind of a
I could see that
a vacuum.
But at the same time, I think
confusion,
because originally it wasn't, the TV show wasn't going to end obviously the way the movie ended. And basically, in the film, how, you know, Adam Kesher's film gets shut down, that's paralleling what happened to this project. It got shut down, the TV show, and David Lynch was just sort of abandoned it, and then he said, oh, I thought of a way to end it, and that's where the dream comes in.
And there's a lot of stuff in this film that isn't just about the failed actress Diane Sullivan. There's a lot of Lynch just taking shot after shot at the Hollywood system.
Right.
That scene where Adam is in the room of mobsters discussing who he's going to cast in his film, that is such a bizarre, hilarious scene that's just sort of taking the piss out of Hollywood. And there's a I guess he's a producer that asked for an espresso.
There's two brothers. They're played by Dan Hedaya, and the other one is actually played by Angelo Badalamenti, who does the soundtrack for this film.
I want to talk about that in a bit.
And he asked for an espresso, and they're very nervous because they know he loves espresso.
Yes, espresso. This guy is the espresso king. And so he gets this espresso, and he asks for a napkin in advance so that he can spit it out because it is not to his liking. Yeah.
It doesn't even get down his throat.
This is some gourmet shit right here.
it barely touches his tongue, and then he spits it, and he doesn't spit it out the way...
It just, like, dribbles out of his mouth.
It's not the way you and I would spit something out. He literally just, like, opens his mouth, and it just falls out.
Yeah, and he just won't let it hit his gullet. It's such a funny scene, and it's... And then after that, you cut to this guy pulling all the strings behind the scenes, and he's enclosed in glass.
Right, yeah.
And his head's enormous.
Well, he's played by, I forget the actor's name, but he's a, I don't want to say the offensive term, the little person.
But they have him on this.
Like, he's wearing like a fake body.
Yeah, he's got a fake body. It's the strangest thing, but it's just making fun of the studio system because Lynch, this was done in a foreign studio. I think it was Studio Canal, a French studio.
Yeah, they're French.
Because, you know, nobody would, nobody in Hollywood would put this out because it was so bizarre. But, needless to say.
Mulholland Rue, that's what it's called. That was like a French joke.
No.
I tried.
I know you tried, and it's all right.
We're all disappointed.
Trying is half the battle.
I just love the way this movie looks. I love the performances. This was Naomi Watts' breakout performance.
Yes.
And Laura Harring.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about the performances, because pretty much everyone is great in this movie.
Yeah.
But Naomi Watts in particular, I mean, I saw this a while ago, so rewatching it, I'm not going to say shocked, but I was taken aback at how
incredible
she is in this movie. This is a very demanding sort of performance, and she does a lot of acting with just her expressions. Mm-hmm. There's a scene at the end, near the end, where after she wakes up and she's just basically hallucinating, and she thinks she sees Laura Harring's character in the kitchen, and she's like, oh, you've come back to me, but then she realizes she's not there, and she literally just like starts shaking, and this look on her face is just it's upsetting. Just the look she has in this, she looks just traumatized.
She's great. She's just a great actress.
She is.
And you forget that when you see her in stuff like Australia, you know, stuff that is
that's Nicole Kidman.
Oh, it is Nicole.
But they look a lot alike.
I always get the two confused.
But yeah, stop drinking my codeine.
Sorry, Dave. But yeah, I think they're fantastic actresses, both of them. They're two of my favorites.
Yeah, but she's so good in it. And there's
21 Grams she was in, yeah. Which is not my favorite movie, but she's excellent in that.
The other scene I love is the scene where they go to Silencio and she just starts like shaking in her chair. And
yeah.
That's sort of just that character's way. The way I interpreted that scene is that's that character realizing she's dreaming and she's about to wake up. And so she's just physically trying to stay in the dream. Yeah. And
the dream is breaking down. Right. And anytime you see the color blue in this film, right. it's a signifier of change. Whether you're shifting from one part of the dream to another or shifting from one level of sleep to like closer to being awake. Which I buy. I buy all of that.
Right.
Because anytime you see blue, it's a change signifier. You can go back. I watched this movie twice. It's one of the few films that I watched twice in 1 week and got something new out of it every time. But yeah, there's so much to this movie.
Well, yeah. The first time you watch it, you're expecting a traditional narrative.
Because it's 2 hours of this dream that you don't know is a dream until the last 20 minutes. And even then, you're a little confused.
So a rewatch pretty much is necessary.
It's mandatory.
And also, I don't think this is true of all movies, but this is one of those movies that you absolutely have to watch it beginning to end uninterrupted. There are movies that I will freely admit you can watch like an hour of, stop and watch the rest like another day. But this movie, it requires, and so much so that David Lynch, when he approved the DVD transfer of the film, he specifically made it so there aren't chapters. You can't skip anything. Yeah. You literally have to watch it from beginning to end on DVD.
Because if it were broken up, then you would lose that dream aspect.
Exactly. It loses the effect.
And I have to say that this is one of the best artistic illustrations of how a dream works that I've ever seen.
Absolutely.
It's not. I'd put it up there with that episode of The Sopranos, The Test Dream.
Yes.
Or Inception.
I like Inception.
I do too.
This is far better. This is far deeper than Inception.
It's more grounded. It's more psychological.
Yeah.
That is true. It does feel like, so
everything Mulholland is slightly off.
It feels like a dream without the traditional movie dream shit. Like,
exactly.
Like, it doesn't seem like you're watching a dream, but no, it feels like a dream.
No, but something's off about it.
Yeah.
And it's almost like one of those dreams where you're not sure that you're dreaming.
Yeah.
And you're like, am I going to wake up at any moment?
Exactly,
And another thing Lynch does, and I mean, he's a master at sound editing, Lynch is, but he uses sound to such an effect in this movie. That Winky scene specifically, when they're walking out to the dumpster, the sound, the camera's almost shaking, and you can hear like this vibration happening.
That whole sequence is incredible. That's probably one of the
and it's just a scene of a guy walking towards a dumpster, but for some reason you're feeling this great dread that most horror movies can't make you feel.
That scene is just creepy from beginning to end, and it's all the more remarkable because it's set in like the brightest broad daylight, and very few filmmakers can pull that off, or they can make a scene scary in just that bright light.
Because
it's hard to do that, because people associate, you know, fear with darkness and stuff like that.
And another masterful scene is the audition that Naomi Watts' Betty character goes on, where she has the greatest audition anyone's ever had.
It's so good.
And you literally forget you're watching another movie. You're automatically drawn into this movie she's auditioning for, because the performance that she gives in this audition is so amazing, and the sound is completely removed. There's no sound other than these two characters talking, and you're just really affected by it.
And even the guy in that scene is good.
Excellent.
He's sort of supposed to be like this washed. He's played by an actor.
He's a silvered fox.
Yeah, he's played by an actor named Chad Everett, and later they say he's sort of like a washed up alcoholic, but his performance is great, and it's sort of like her performance makes his better.
Yeah.
Because she goes into the scene and everyone's sort of just like, oh, they're joking around. They can tell the script is like a dog. It's like a shitty script.
Yeah.
But she elevates the material. She's so good in the sequence that she makes him therefore better.
And part of that is another, like, it's a sort of a nod to old Hollywood, because this dialogue is old Hollywood style dialogue. And this Betty character in the dream is an idealized version of Diane Selwyn, this, you know, kid from the country with she won a jitterbug contest out to Hollywood, and she's got bright eyes and she's just happy to be here.
Yeah.
Whereas when we flip to Diane Selwyn, she like even her teeth are a little yellowed.
Yeah.
And she has bags under her eyes and she's this failed, miserable actress.
Right. In the dream, she's the best actress in the world.
She's incredible.
And, but you find out when you wake up, she find out, you know.
And her lover, played by what's her name?
Laura Harring.
I always forget her first name. Laura Harring. She's everything that Diane loved about Laura Harring in the beginning of the relationship. That's why she's just this great person.
Yeah.
She's a blank slate of a person. And that's why I don't agree that this film feels, you know, kind of loose, like you said, Dave. I think it's so tight and everything ties together. If you rewatch it several times, you everything makes sense. Everything fits. It's like it's one of the few movies I've seen where there are no loose ends.
Yeah, like I'd say of all of Lynch's weird movies, this is the one that's probably the most concise. It just, I'm not gonna say everything gets wrapped up in a neat little package, but I feel like everything you need to know is there. And
yeah, that's a good way to put it. Everything you need to know is presented, whether you know it or not. But upon further rewatches, it will all make sense.
Yeah, David Lynch has said that. He won't answer any questions about the plot of Holland Drive. Everything you need is on the screen. But I don't know. The first time I watched it, I took it as these things are both happening congruently, and Naomi Watts is just playing two different people.
And I can see, because the first time I watched it, I thought, well, this is interesting. I don't know that I like this very much. It took two watches for me to really, really fall in love with this movie.
Yeah, I think
because there's a scene where she goes, oh, those two FBI agents were here again looking for you. But we never see that scene, but we do see Laura Harring's character,
Rita
come and ask questions about her. So it's like,
I feel like that's like a deliberate sort of like trick he's trying to pull.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah,
I mean, I think I agree with the dream thing more because there's the waitress named Betty, so she's going to this diner a lot and sees this person named Betty, then is like,
it's
and
like Betty,
she's transposing
her. It's such a goody two-shoes name, Betty, you know?
It's just probably like, oh, this lady's here to become an actress. She doesn't want to be a waitress. And so she kind of imagines that, like, clean slate almost.
It's sort of like everything she has seen, it's imprinted, because that's what happens with dreams. You dream about shit. You barely even notice, and you're like, why did I dream about that? And you put it together.
Yeah, I'm always dreaming about you two.
Yeah, I don't know why.
You're just jogging through my house with headphones on.
But I would say that this is my favorite Lynch film, and I watched Lost Highway a couple days before I watched this, and I hadn't seen that film since the 90s, and boy, oh boy, was I reminded of how much I hate Lost Highway. And it's not even the plot of Lost Highway that I have a problem with. It's the look of that. I think that is a hideous looking film.
Oh, really?
I hate it. I hate the way Lost Highway looks. Whereas this film, not only does it have everything I like about Lynch with the weird, twisted way that he films things, but it just looks gorgeous and it sounds gorgeous and he gets some of the best performances I've ever seen out of his actors. It's just fantastic. Personally, this is a 10 out of 10 movie for me.
Nice.
This is a 10 out of 10 for Jeff Rollins from cutprintfilm.com.
This is definitely one of my favorite Lynch movies, and it's fantastic. I will disagree that I'll always have a soft spot for Lost Highway. I think Lost Highway.
That soft spot is cancer.
Hey.
The biopsies come back.
I'll take what I can get. But I mean, Lost Highway almost feels like it's a audition for this movie.
Yeah,
a lot of the same themes are that duality is in Lost Highway, and like
is Gene Poole in Lost Highway?
He's the first assistant director of Lost Highway, and Lynch does that same thing where it's got and Twin Peaks had this too, where it's like the one girl has the dark hair and the one has the blonde hair, and that's sort of that like that reminded me of that Mad Men episode where they make the ad and it's like Jackie O and Marilyn Monroe. Yeah. It's sort of like the two types of women.
Yeah, I like that. I also like that Laura Harring's character dons that blonde wig and eventually starts looking more and more like Betty.
Betty, yeah.
And that just shows that, you know, she's slowly waking up. But.
Right. So what did everyone think of Justin Theroux in the film?
I loved him.
He was so good. He was so good.
He's actually one of my favorite parts of the movie, just because his scenes, the scenes that he's in, are just, they feel more anchored in like some kind of actual movie reality.
I think he's good in the movie, but he's probably my least
favorite part of this film, honestly. Like, if he weren't in the film, I probably wouldn't mind
at
all.
You wouldn't lose anything if he weren't in it. But he's kind of necessary because he's the one that took Rita away for,
I think I like
Camilla,
him.
Took Camilla away from Diane.
I like him more in the waking part when he's playing a fucking asshole.
Yeah,
I feel like in the first half where he's supposed to be like a nicer guy, I don't buy it. Just because Justin Theroux always strikes me as just like
an asshole.
That's like a scumbag. Like, and not, that's not like against him. I just think that's how he seems to me.
I do like that he. In the dream, he's constantly getting shit on,
right?
And it's Diane's subconscious,
right,
just
shitting
piling
on
and piling on him,
right,
because of what he did to her or what she perceives he did to her.
Yeah, and she's even dreaming an excuse for him. Like, it's not that she's not good enough; it's that this is all the stuff that went on
right.
Behind
the mob told him you have to. Choose.
It's like a paranoid delusion.
Yeah, it's like a conspiracy, basically. Her dream is that everyone at that party is just against her, like, and they're the ones who've ruined her life, and it's not, you know, it's not just fate or whatever.
There's just something about it that like didn't connect with me. Like I found myself not caring about Rita, and she's like the emphasis of the first half almost, and because of that, it's hard to.
I was fascinated by that character, but I wanted to know. Like, what is this blue box? What is this key? What is this?
I think maybe what...
I wish Dennis Hopper from Blue Velvet came out of the box.
Out of the box.
It's like, fuck yeah!
I think it's just that Naomi Watts' performance is so commanding. And Laura Herring is very good in this too, but I just think Naomi Watts sort of steals the limelight out from her.
She's incredible.
Definitely.
Yeah. So I think that might be what you're thinking, where you're not as interested, because it's not as investing as to pay attention to her as Naomi Watts.
I also want to briefly mention the score, because it's incredible.
16-4.
No, not that score, Dave.
We do scores on the eights.
Not the cricket score. Who's winning the cricket match, everyone? Dave Casa will tell you
it,
too.
I believe it was Lord Bullington.
this score is incredible, and it's another one of the great things Lynch does with sound. This is a horror film score.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of that movie Memento,
the
Nolan
movie.
Film. A lot of the themes from that score is in this film, and I love that score. I love it, and I loved this too. And it just filled me with this dread every time the Mulholland Drive theme would start up.
It's
upsetting. This slow string music. Oh, it's terrifying.
I mean, Jeff had said we were talking about the off air that this is like one of the most.
During the pre-show.
One of the scariest non-horror films he had ever seen. And I would even argue that I look at this as a horror film. It I look at this like and it. Lost Highway both as horror films. They're like, they're art house horror.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
And it's a scary movie. There are scary scenes in this movie that do better horror than quote-unquote full-blown horror movies.
And because this is a dream, it's a lot of fantastic, it's just fantastic standalone scene after fantastic standalone scene. And that's what I like about Paul Thomas Anderson films. He films these amazing cinematic scenes.
Yeah. Right.
They're more, you know, based on a coherent storyline.
But they aren't self-contained little things that you can watch on their own.
Yeah. It's just that's why I love this movie so much, because it reminded me of one of my favorite directors, Paul Thomas Anderson, I think.
Nice.
Aside from everything else that I love about the movie,
and
the themes and all that.
Even the... what did everyone think of the cowboy scene? I just want to talk about that scene just because I like it so much.
I don't know that I 100% understand it.
Right.
But
I mean, the only thing I get from that is at the party, she just briefly sees a guy walk by as a cowboy.
Yeah.
I think that's just like her subconscious just weirdly projecting that.
Yeah, and he
something.
Says, you know, if you do right, you'll see me one more time. If you do bad, you'll see me two more times.
Right.
And, you know, you see him two more times after that scene.
I love that performance. I just love... That's one of those things, like, it's so weird that I don't want it to be explained. Like, it works better as, like, what the hell is this?
It's spellbinding. The whole film is spellbinding, but that scene in particular is just meant. This guy is not to be fucked with,
and
this cowboy.
The actor.
What was that Altman movie we watched with the cowboy?
McCabe and Mrs. Miller?
No, the other one.
Fool for Love?
Yeah. That cowboy kind of reminded me of that character.
I could see that.
And that movie takes
Shepherd
place
character.
In, like, a weird...
Dreamy sort of. Yeah, I could definitely see that. But this
film actually worked.
That the actor he shaved his eyebrows, and I think that
yeah,
goes
hair,
like goes, just, yeah.
It's just something directly out of a dream.
And like he walks up and that light turns on when he walks.
It's almost as though maybe he's her manifestation of justice, whereas the creature behind the dumpster is her manifestation of guilt. This is justice because, you know, he's the one that wakes her up. And
nice.
Time to wake up, pretty girl.
I can definitely see that. And then the only other thing I would ask is, what do you think the old people represent? I would say, I look at that as like those are like her parents.
That's exactly what
just,
I think.
They're just like, she realizes like they'd be they wouldn't be proud of what she's become, and she just can't take it anymore. I mean, Dave, what do you think?
I didn't really think about it because, again, there's so many other symbols in the movie that it starts to get – you get, like, symbol fatigue.
Right.
Yeah, you do.
So I just start taking things in as, you know, those are old people, you know?
Yeah, I think they're from her past. I think they represent her past because she comes from, like, a podunk town. Because
they're the ones who, in the beginning of the dream, they're the ones who set her off into the world. Yeah. They let her go and –
And I mean, I don't know. Like I said, this is a dream. There's no, you're not going to convince me otherwise. Nobody will. Yeah, the goddamn film opens with a head falling down on a pillow, fading to black.
Exactly.
I mean, I think it's like the old people could symbolize like, okay, so all of this Hollywood bullshit is just to satiate a need for middle America and old people who go to the movies.
That too.
You know what I mean? So it's like, that's constantly on her, like, because that's the true motivation of why we make entertainment art.
Yeah,
is for people sitting there just watching their TV, like Videodrome.
Yeah,
and that even ties back to Blue Velvet, where you know people are watching true crime on TV as entertainment. I think that's one of Lynch's things.
Yeah,
one of his themes.
The more we talk, like with whatever the last one was that I didn't like that much. The more we talk about this, the more I like it.
I really want you to like go back and watch this right now. We're gonna watch you. I do think if you go back and watch it at a removed time, I think you will like it more.
Is there like a director's cut or anything with extended footage?
This is pretty much it.
There's a Dolly grip cut. Not very good.
Because I remember I saw this when it came, not when it came out, probably like 2002. I saw it and I didn't remember loving it at the time, but it's definitely a film that just the more I've watched it, the more I realize how fucking good it is.
And that's why I think this is an actual masterpiece, because it's rewarding on multiple watches. You could watch this 100 times and just pick out different things that you missed. And only masterpieces do that.
I mean, one of the things I love about David Lynch as a filmmaker is that he doesn't make easy films. And sometimes films shouldn't be easy. I mean, there's plenty of room for "quote unquote," you know, mindless entertainment.
Yeah.
And but there's
we talked about one at the beginning of the show. Furious 7.
And like, I think there's room for all kinds of movies. And like, nothing bothers me more than people who are just like, I go to movies to be entertained. Like, no one's arguing that.
Yeah, of course you do.
Yeah, but there's room for movies like this too. That just they're not setting out to easily entertain you. They want you to think about them. And I don't know. I love that.
I typically love that, but for some reason here, I'm not head over heels. I recognize that it's an amazing movie. Cinematically, as you were saying, like it looks wonderful. You could watch it with the volume off and be like,
yeah, that's a good point.
This is something you put on and like project on a wall.
This is
during
art.
A party, you know what I mean?
And I want to say going into this David Lynch director series, I was of the mind that he's, you know, he just does things to be weird. He's weird on purpose, just to turn people off. And I've completely turned the corner on that. I think he's one of the best living directors there are. I think he's a master at the craft. He's an abstractionist. Is that the term that he uses?
Yeah.
And I completely buy everything David Lynch does, hook, line, and sinker. Still not a big fan of Twin Peaks.
Right.
Still not a big fan of that. But I have loved every single movie we've talked about in this director series, and I'm hesitant to go into Inland Empire.
let me just say, I love David Lynch. I loved him before this director series, but Inland Empire, I can't get through it. Maybe I should rewatch it now that I'm older and wiser, but when I saw it, I remember thinking, I wish this would end.
But yeah, I am a Lynch fan at this point.
That was his
Lynch-aholic.
Last movie, right?
That was the last thing he did, and he was supposed to be doing the new Twin Peaks show, and that's apparently not happening. So, So David Lynch.
Yeah, what do you think, Dave? Because you were kind of with me on the David Lynch thing before.
Yeah. And I mean, I had about as much exposure to him as you did, but I don't know. I recognize that he's an amazing director, and that he has done a lot for cinema. Like, you watching these David Lynch movies, you see like it's the same as watching a Quentin Tarantino movie or something like that. You see these iconic things happening that now happen. They're appropriated for other movies and made more like friendly. You know, what I mean?
They're normalized now.
But they're
for
still
mass consumption.
Yeah, like with De Palma too. You see David Lynch's signature on other movies,
right?
I think it's interesting that of all the directors done so far, except maybe Kubrick, David Lynch is like the one who hasn't quote unquote sold out. He's not the one who hasn't made like the boring Hollywood movie.
And he just does whatever he wants.
Right. Because I'm sure he's,
for art's sake,
I'm sure he's gotten plenty of offers to do like bigger Hollywood things. I mean, I guess he started that with Dune early in his career, and then that didn't work, and he was like, "I don't ever want to do that again."
Yeah,
so that is admirable.
Yeah, that's he's
recording albums with Saint Vincent.
Right.
He's doing commercials.
He does what he wants to do. And that's cool. So, who's our next director for the director series?
Dave, why don't you tell us?
Akira Kurosawa.
Our first
Irish director.
Our first foreign director, unless you count David Cronenberg, since he's Canadian. So
I
that's
do.
Sort of foreign.
I do. I don't trust a Canadian as far as I can throw him, which is 200 yards. I've measured.
Is Catherine Bigelow Canadian? I don't know why I thought that.
No,
Bam Bam Bigelow.
Oh, okay. That was the mix-up.
That's a lie. He's from North Jersey.
Yes. He was from the shore, I believe. So our first film will be Rashomon, I believe, which I'm sure I'm saying wrong like an idiot American.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll have all our Japanese down by next week.
No, we won't. Yeah, we'll have none of it down.
I'm a little nervous for this series just for that reason, that I don't want to sound like a doofus pronouncing these names incorrectly. So.
I picked Kurosawa because in that director's chair series that I mentioned before on the podcast, Quentin Tarantino cited him and Sergio Leone as his two main influences.
Right.
So I figured I've never seen any Akira movie, so we might as well go down that path.
Why not?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's sort of the point of the director series, to expose not just you, but also us to filmmakers we may not be as familiar with as we wish to be.
That's right. So next week, look forward to part two of our Mel Brooks director series. And now...
No, Jeff.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had that all wrong. We'll be doing Akira Kurosawa.
That's right.
And do you guys want to recommend some movies?
Let's go for it.
One of our favorites.
I forgot about that one.
All right. Let's recommend some movies. Who's going first?
I'll go.
Oh, good.
I rarely go first. So my pick is a documentary, which I don't recommend that much because who the fuck cares? My pick is 2012's My Amityville Horror.
Oh.
And so this film, it stars Daniel Lutz, who is one of the children.
Oh, boy, I saw this.
He's one of the children of the people who lived at the Amityville Horror House. And it's just basically about him and his life now, and he is a lunatic.
No, I thought he was a very well-adjusted gentleman.
So he clearly still believes that all this stuff happened. You know, there were ghosts and all this stuff, even though it's been proven time and time again that the Lutzes, the people who live in the house, made it all up for money. But so what you get from this film is that Daniel Lutz is a very traumatized man, and that his stepfather was very abusive to him. And basically the abuse sort of just triggered this thing in his mind that he just thinks all this crazy stuff actually happened in the Amityville house. And, I mean, I won't call it a great documentary. It's very cheaply made. It's, you know, it's there aren't a lot of people in it.
There's no research.
Yeah. They're just making it up as they go. And, it's worth watching just to watch Daniel Lutz be himself, because he's clearly just this damaged weirdo, and there's all these shots where he's in his garage just like riffing on guitars and stuff like that. And
yeah, oh yes, there's like a 3-minute scene of him just plucking away on the strings,
just jamming, and it's just interesting because he really seems insane. And there's a scene where he goes to visit Lorraine Warren, who was a character in the film The Conjuring, and she's a quote-unquote psychic, and
She's also another person who's been proven time and time again to be a fucking lunatic.
She is a cuckoo bird, as we call stuff them here.
And so there's a scene where he's in her kitchen, and they're talking about the haunting, and she takes out this store-bought thing, and she goes, "This is a piece of the true cross that Christ was crucified on." And you can tell this thing was, like, made in Japan.
I'd venture a guess that it isn't.
Yeah, so...
A Home Depot sticker on it.
It might as well have that. It's clearly just something she bought at a store, and I like watching movies about people who are lunatics and don't realize they're lunatics, and that's what this movie is. So it's called My Amityville Horror. It's on Netflix Instant.
Ooh.
Never do a Slim Jim. Oh yeah.
Oh,
I like to keep it topical. Okay.
Who's next? Me?
Yeah, sure.
I'm going to direct a movie from last year that got kind of a bad rap.
You're going to direct the movie? Well, Dave.
Recommend. Sorry, I am very sick.
Dave has rickets.
This movie was directed by Angelina Jolie. That's what I meant to say when I said I directed it.
Visionary director.
And it got kind of a bad rap because the trailers looked bad and... it's directed by Angelina Jolie, so you kind of think like this is just like an actor with too much money and time on their hands trying to get into the craft of directing, which isn't something you can just get into. But Unbroken is actually pretty good of a movie.
That's what I heard.
The first half, particularly. It's about Louis Zepparini, this guy from World War I who got captured by the Japanese and survived in a he survived a plane crash in the Pacific. Then survived the Japanese concentration camp.
Oh, so he's a wuss.
Yes, he's not a real man like us down here with our headphones
in
on.
In a basement.
But the early scenes where they're on the B-52 bombers are fucking gorgeous, and they're awesome. I've never seen anything like this in another World War II movie, which is why this is cool. These rickety old bombers up in the sky, which are like the size of, I don't know, something big.
yes. And my ego, perhaps.
They're literally barely held together.
Right.
Pieces of shit that they would send these guys off over the Pacific in. And they're just really cool scenes. They have
Do the B-52s sing Rock Lobster?
Yeah. They have this awesome, like, vintage quality to them while you're watching them. Even though, like, the movie's a little too glitzy, and that's what I don't like about the trailers.
Yeah, that's sort of, like, that turned me off when the trailer. It looked like the... typical Hollywood war sort of movie.
But it kind of works in the movie because it makes it feel like World War II propaganda, you know what I mean? Almost. And I like that about it. I don't think that was the intention, but it does have this this like faux feeling to it that makes it worth watching.
It also stars Jack O'Connell, who was in Startup and 71 from last year.
Oh, yeah.
Both excellent.
He's good in this. He was great in 71.
He's fantastic in Startup. This is a great actor.
I have not seen him in anything yet, so I'll have to get on the ball.
The Coen brothers helped to write the script.
I remember hearing that, and that's weird to me.
And Domhnall Gleeson's in it, and he's very good in it.
Nice.
So, yeah, check it out. Unbroken from last year.
Nice.
Never do a Slim Jim. Oh, yeah.
Now that we all have heart disease from all these Slim Jims, I'll go ahead and recommend my pick this week. It's inspired by David Lynch's Mulholland Drive. It is Sunset Boulevard.
Wow, I came so close to picking this for the same reason.
I was hoping none of you were going to recommend this as well, because I wouldn't have had a backup pick, because I'm lazy.
I'm recommending Nightmare on Elm Street.
Good. It's a little late, Dave.
This is Sunset Boulevard. Came out in 1950. It's directed by the great Billy Wilder.
Right.
And it stars William Holden, Gloria Swanson, and Eric von Stroheim. And this is a famous film about an actress who is long past her prime, but she still has these delusions of a comeback.
She was a silent film star.
Yeah, and this takes place post-silent film era, but... a lot of her friends have moved on into the talkies, but she never moved on. But she keeps insisting that she's great and she's going to have a comeback. She still knows all these directors and people, and she's going to have a comeback. And so she sort of enlists the help of this screenwriter played by William Holden, and he's kind of her a kept man.
Yeah, he's sort of like a gigolo, if you will.
She's his sugar mama, and she buys him all these expensive, lavish things to keep him living in her enormous mansion. And
who can blame him?
It really plays out like a full-length version of a Twilight Zone episode. I've seen Twilight Zone episodes that remind me of this film, so there's definitely some give and take there. And it has that great line, I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille.
Right.
Does it have like a wacky ending like that?
Yeah, an ape squeezes a banana and it goes into the air and down his mouth. I didn't understand it either.
And he goes, Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, this is a great, great movie. It's black and white.
Oh, forget it. God.
It's a dark comedy. It's really, really funny. Right. I can't believe some of the things that they got away with in 1950. But yeah, that's my pick. 1950s Sunset Boulevard.
Ooh.
Oh, no. The show's over.
Well, that's all for this week. We'll be back next week with Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon.
Yes.
And I don't know if anything else modern comes out. Does anything good come out this week?
Ex Machina comes out next week. Well, we won't have seen
that before. That's it.
Sorry, everybody. Yeah, go to cutprintfilm.com for all your movie review needs.
Right.
Follow us on Twitter at cutprintfilm.
Right.
Like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/cutprintfilm. Hey, we have some friends that have websites and podcasts.
Right, but who cares? I mean,
oh, I was going to plug them.
Oh, more. I'm sorry.
Joystickjerks.com. They are a podcast. They talk about video games. They're very funny. They're very
handsome.
Well, yes, they are three handsome boys, but they're very crude. So don't listen to this in front of your infant child.
Oh no.
Who else can you check out?
They're sweet too.
They are.
They're crude sweet.
Oil. They're little sweet boys. you could check out antifanboy.com. They talk about video games and movies and all sorts of pop culture-y sort of stuff.
Comic books.
Right. That's
all that jazz.
If it happened, they talk about
it. That's right.
That's their motto.
I don't know that it is.
Chernobyl meltdown. Yeah. Whatever happens, they'll talk about it.
Tomorrow's news today.
Right. And as always, we encourage you, our listening audience, to go to iTunes and give this very show a 5-star rating and write a little hilarious review. And if your review is funny enough or interesting enough, we'll read it on air.
Yeah. You can say, hey, Jeff, I noticed that you grow facial hair at an alarming rate. Well, that's because I was bitten by a wolf once on the Tall Pines.
He was bitten by Jack Nicholson on the set of Wolf.
Yes. It was not very nice. I got an infection and I had to have my arm amputated from the elbow down.
Oh no.
Very upsetting.
Yeah, better than the elbow up.
Yes. Again.
Just your forearm floating in air.
It's very disturbing. So yeah, that's our spiel. Give us that good review on iTunes. We demand it.
Yes.
We need it. We thrive on good reviews. Do not bother giving us a bad review because
we'll delete it.
I know Joseph iTunes and I'll have him delete it.
Oh,
yes.
The iTunes Baron.
Yes.
Well, that was it. We made it through.
Yeah.
Unscathed.
It took us 3 weeks and you're sick and, you know, all that stuff.
I have a cease and desist letter. It's a bad week.
I have a C-section scar.
Oh.
I gave birth to a delicious boysenberry pie.
Does this ever end?
No. Oh, Jesus. It's a 10-minute outro. I think we should talk to somebody about it, though.
Yeah.
Who?
Robert Loggia.
Mm.
Keep it down.
Keep it down.